On WSLR LP 96.5 in Sarasota, this is Florence Farringer with your WSLR News headlines for April 23rd, 2024. The Justice for Briante Coalition is holding a press conference ahead of today's Manatee County Commission meeting, calling for the implementation of the Community Assistance and Life Liaison Program, CALL program for short. This follows the death of Briante Johnson while in custody of Palmetto police officers just last year. The CALL program would have social workers respond to certain 911 calls, rather than having police respond to every type of call. Briante was experiencing a bout of paranoia when someone called 911, the caller clarifying that Briante needed medical help and that nobody was in danger. Four officers arrived, forced Briante to the ground, handcuffed him, and tased him, inducing cardiac arrest, and causing his death the following day. Aside from the implementation of the CALL program, the Justice for Briante Coalition is also calling for a more thorough investigation into his death, as well as the termination and indictment of the officers involved. The press conference and rally is happening today at 8 in the morning, outside of the Manatee County Commission building. Sarasota's 211 service has become the target of the County Commission's scrutiny in the recent past. The County Commission is meeting today, where further cuts to the program remain on the agenda. One of the main complaints of the All-Republican Commission is that the service could possibly refer people to Planned Parenthood, an organization which has captured the ire of the pro-life movement. The nonprofit behind 211, United Way's Suncoast, revealed that in the last fiscal year, of the over 13,000 referrals it made, not a single one was to Planned Parenthood. Some bad news for Tex-Mex lovers across the country. The Florida-based restaurant chain Tijuana Flats has closed 11 of its locations and filed for bankruptcy. The company has not given a list of the locations it closed, but among the dead lies the Tamiami location just south of downtown Sarasota. Other locations have been reported closed across the state. The company was sold to Flatheads LLC last year, the Flatheads ultimately deciding that bankruptcy and closed locations was the best course of action for the company. This has been Florence Farringer with your WSLR News headlines for April 23rd, 2024.
Good morning. You are listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota. This is the Healthy Living Hour, airing live every other Tuesday from 9 to 10 a.m. Eastern Time. My name is Rebecca, and I am your host. A huge thank you to our soundboard operator, Alvaro Montalegre. Alvaro, I couldn't do this without you. Thank you so much for coming here every other week to do this with me. Our goal is to offer a wide variety of topics and guests to better inform and educate our community on current health and wellness issues. As a disclaimer, everything said here today is uncensored, can be extremely diverse, and does not necessarily reflect the views of WSLR, nor their staff or volunteers. Further, no one here is providing any type of medical diagnosis, treatment, nor advice. Everything said here on the Healthy Living Hour is solely for general information and to foster critical thinking. We encourage you to consult your doctor for personal medical advice. Thanks again for joining us today. This is just a disclaimer. This is a pre-recorded show. So have what I believe is a very special treat for my listening audience today. I reached out to one of my mentors. Many of my patients know that I am a practitioner of functional medicine. It's kind of a buzzword these days. Well, one of the big things is that we believe that one of the root causes of disease is inflammation. And so we're going to talk about an anti-inflammatory diet today. And I reached out to one of my teachers, my good mentor, and I you know, call a friend, Dr. Brandon Lindell, who is in Longmont, Colorado. And he agreed to allow me to air on air today his doctor training, one of his trainings. It's a functional medicine anti-inflammatory diet. So many of you have probably seen this, heard this out there. Well, what is it and why is it important? So I just want to do a little disclaimer. This is actually part of a doctor's training that Dr. Lundell gave us. And I purchased the recording, and he is allowing us to air this over the airwaves today because, like myself, he believes that this is important and truly crucial to get this in the hands of everybody who's willing to listen, who's willing to just give it a try, who wants to understand this more, to really change their health outcomes and really stack the cards in their favor as we walk through life. So a little word on Dr. Lundell here. Dr. Lundell has been practicing and teaching integrative health and medicine for over 15 years. His approach to patient care empowers patients to take their health back by understanding the cellular, dietary, and lifestyle origins of disease. He uses laboratory, physical, and history findings to uncover the source of ill health and organ system dysfunction. His practice style is truly integrative, taking the best Western medicine has to offer and combining it with the most effective natural first therapies. He has developed a certification course for licensed healthcare practitioners called Nutritional Pathology, and that is what I have personally studied with him. This provides educational tools and resources to help doctors improve the lives of even their toughest cases. Classes cover laboratory evaluations, endocrinology, autoimmune, gastroenterology, neurology, genetics, epigenetics, toxicology, environmental health, and more. Dr. Lundell has served as an adjunct professor at Southern California University of Health Sciences, where he developed and taught a functional medicine program for doctorate students. He also teaches for several other organizations throughout the country, including the Council on Diagnosis and Internal Disorders, and has published articles in peer-reviewed publications and health periodicals. He also serves as clinical science advisor to the nutraceutical industry and has developed several unique and effective formulations that have been used in thousands of practices worldwide. This is a two-part series for our program. Part one will be today. We will air part two, the remainder part, in about 1 month, and I will announce that. Without further ado, here he is giving some insight to the anti-inflammatory diet.
So we're going to talk about today diet, which is one of the most important things we can talk about. There's a lot out there, so I want to kind of bring it all into one place. This isn't the only resource you're going to have, but I've read thousands of books, thousands of articles. I've applied this to thousands of patients. So this is kind of what I have seen work the best for the most number of patients and most number of people. Of course, diet isn't the only thing when we talk about healing. We have to have the three-legged stool, which nutrition and diet is just one part. We have supplementation. We have everything that we need to take in. That's just one leg of the stool. We have the lifestyle, which is another leg of the stool, exercise, stress reduction, relaxation, you know, taking care of our spiritual needs. And then we have taking care of the physical structure, chiropractic, nervous system, other body work, neuromuscular, acupuncture. So if all three of those legs aren't, the reason why we use this analogy is because if all three of these legs aren't strong and aren't working, then the stool is kind of useless. It kind of falls over. And it doesn't matter how strong you have the other two legs. If there's one leg that's a little missing, then it doesn't matter how many supplements you take. It doesn't matter how much you exercise if your diet's off. You know, see, what I find is usually people have two out of those three, but very few people have all of those three working. And then if not, if there isn't all three of those legs, then there's going to be some health, you know, dis-ease or some kind of illness that eventually will take place. So we're only going to talk about diet, but I find that this is one of the most important. It is certainly probably one of the most important factors in our health, and because there's so much confusion out there as to what really works. There's, as we know, a million diets out there, which we'll get to, and we'll kind of try to look at it in terms of what's the most common aspects of all of those. So we're just going to talk about nutrition and the diet aspect, and not necessarily even the supplementation. That's going to be up to your individual circumstances and has to be individualized to what's going on for you. But there's no way out of the fact that everyone will have to spend a lot of time on money or and money on either health or sickness. The great thing is about that, you know, we can either choose. We get to choose what we spend our money on. You know, some people think that eating very well is very expensive, but actually the opposite is true. You're going to be cooking more of your own food. You're going to be saving some costs there, and you're going to be healthier and more productive in your life. So by far, the money that you spend on your diet is going to pay for itself. Probably it's the best investment you can make. So we all know sickness is very expensive, and not only on our bodies, but a lot of money into the healthcare system. So what would you rather spend your time and money on? Health or disease? You get to choose. So there's a couple of principles. First of all, there's no one diet. I don't propose that everybody have just one diet. Everybody is individual. There's genetics at play. There's environment at play. It's what you grew up eating. It's what works for you in this moment, given your circumstances. There's very sophisticated interplay between, you know, the chemicals and the environment that you are living in now and how they cross-react with your foods and what foods are available and local foods. So we're only going to give you some principles today that this is a lifelong journey. You're going to be always working on your diet and always seeing what works and what doesn't, and it'll change often too. So don't think that this is the only diet for everybody. In fact, there's a lot of room in here to adjust it. So we have to individualize it. The first thing I recommend for all of my patients is to get a food allergy or sensitivity testing. That is very unique, given our microbiota, given our different bacteria that are in our gut, given what we have eaten growing up. And even research shows what the mother ate while you were in the womb influences what foods you become sensitized to or desensitized to. So there's a lot of different factors. Also, how active your immune system is going to, you know, change how reactive you are to foods. If you get even a virus, a certain virus or a certain bacteria that you've contracted while you were, in the course of your lifetime, that can make your body produce certain antibodies that can then cross-react with certain foods. So everybody's a little different. Right now, there's in the news, there's a tick. I think it's called the Lone Star tick, even though it's not in Texas. But there's a tick that, and I'll tell you why it's called the Lone Star tick, but if it bites you, your body fights the venom or the, you know, saliva that it secretes, and it's an irritant. And as the body fights that, it's secreting antibodies to fight that. Well, that antibody cross reacts with a protein that's in red meat, mostly cow meat. So you get bit by this tick, and all of a sudden, you know, you wake up a week later, 2 weeks later, after you've had a hamburger, and you've got hives all over the place, and you have nausea, you have vomiting. So, and it's almost impossible to test for all of these things that people have contracted. Even the common cold and flu has been shown to influence what foods you might be sensitive to. And that can last 3 months, 6 months, a year, or an entire lifetime. So it's always going to be a process of experimentation, listening to your body, finding out what works in this moment. But the principles won't change. There's some principles that we're going to talk to that do not change that we want to learn and anchor. Lab testing also, just blood chemistry, that will help you find areas that need special focus. I find in my practice that about 80% of my patients that come in, and maybe even 90 at this point, if they haven't really had a good focus on their diet, if they haven't been instructed well, if they haven't been taking care of themselves, blood sugar is probably one of the most important. And we all know that's a product of our diet. It's a product of our pollution and toxicity and stress. So there's many reasons why most of us have some kind of insulin resistance. And knowing that, that helps us formulate our diet specifically for things that show up. Thyroid, then if thyroid's very low, then you might want to eat foods that have more iodine in them. You want to check for antibodies. You want to check for maybe heavy metals and how that's contributing to the thyroid. If you have anemia, then you might want to, especially iron deficiency or B12 deficiency, that might be common in vegetarians because they don't eat red meat, which has the B12 and some of the iron. So, focusing on areas that come up specifically for you will help you and your healthcare practitioner come up with little changes in the diet that can go a long way. So also experiment, experiment, experiment. Just as soon as you think you've got it figured out, it's going to change. So you're going to feel better. You're going to be very happy that you made these changes in your diet, and you're going to want to stick with them. But there's going to be things that change. Personally, I'll go through periods where I eat certain foods for a while, and then I don't eat them for many months, and just kind of give my body a break depending on how it feels after I've been eating that food for a while. So be flexible and listen to your body. That's the number one principle there. And something that I've noticed and a lot of practitioners have noticed is that in the beginning of this diet, in the beginning of making big changes in your diet, there is this initial excitement because you start feeling better. It's something to focus on. And, you've got resources, you've got help, that there's a community doing this. So it becomes, a little bit easier for some people in the beginning to make these changes. What makes it hard is maintaining these changes. And what I've seen is a lot of people tend to become too restricted for too long. And that stress of really restricting your diet, that's needed at first. And I'll explain that in a second. But as we go along, 6 months, a year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years after you've started your big changing, and this is a big change. This is probably one of the biggest changes you can make in your life. And it should be if it's going to work. But over time, if you're doing the right things and you're becoming healthier, then that you'll develop some leeway. And we just want to be careful that you don't stress about food so much that it becomes counterproductive. Many people, the more stress they get about food, the more food reactions they have. That stress in and of itself causes them to have many food reactions. Oh, I can't have this, I can't have that. And if I have a little bit of this food, I can feel my whole body freak out because I shouldn't, quote unquote, shouldn't have it. So we need to be strict in the beginning and make these changes. But over time, just be aware that I kind of call it the 80-20 or the 90-10 rule. And we'll get to that in the maintenance phase of the diet. So there's a lot of fad diet trends out there. There's, which one's right for me? Of course, there's gluten-free, there's grain-free, there's the FODMAP diet, which is not eating anything that's fermentable, because of how it feeds the bad bacteria in the gut, which can then make you crave more sweets or make you fat, because the bacteria in the gut become very efficient at extracting the calories. So you end up extracting more calories out of your food while you become at the same time nutrient deficient, because those same bacteria are taking up all the nutrients. So there's a lot of play here in the microbiota. There's the gut and psychology. Diet, the paleo diet, vegetarian, vegan, specific carbohydrate diet, Mediterranean diet, you know, etc. I mean, there's just so many diets. So what, which one is right for me? Which one, you know, which one is right? Well, I like to look at the commonalities in all of them, because none of them are right and none of them are wrong. It's taking what is the same out of all of those. And if there's some principles that every one of those diets have, then those must be true, and those must be accepted and as, you know, what we all need to do, instead of fighting over, you know, really ultimately tiny little arguments of whether I should have grains or not have grains. Now, those can make a big difference in your life. That's where individualization of the diet comes in play, and it's very important. But in all of these diets, there's some commonality. So there's, you know, first of all, there's no diet book that I've read, and I've read, you know, dozens and if not 100 of them. I've never read one single diet that says go out and eat sugar and go out and eat soda and go out and eat fast food and go out and just eat however much you want at any time that you want. So there's, you know, the first thing we want is to cut out those processed sugars. We want to focus more on whole, natural, unprocessed foods that, you know, spoil very quickly in your refrigerator, because they're meant to be eaten very quickly. And that's probably the first, you know, hurdle that a lot of people have to get over, is how do I prepare my foods? How do I prepare my foods? Which I'll get to. I've been doing this diet myself for about 15 years, if not longer. And I've been a busy professional and student for most of that time, and I've been able to find a way to make it work. And I'll show you some tricks along the way, and I'll give you some resources of how to make it practical in your life. No preservatives and chemicals. So processed foods, all packaged foods, all of those things have to be limited. And again, preparing your own food is going to be very important. In all of these diets, you have to prepare your own food. There's no perfect diet in a box that you can just rip open and have three times a day and expect to be healthy. Of course, organic. I think most of the food authors at this day and age would agree that organic is very important. Many studies have proven that the organic system that we have is far from perfect, and that's no reason to throw the baby out with the bathwater. It does help limit the amount of pesticides and chemicals that you get in your diet. And of course, it helps at least limit the amount of genetically modified organisms that you get. Because organic right now, and it looks like as of, you know, 2014, 15, 16, you know, getting legislation passed to make GMOs labeled, as it's not going to happen, real quickly. But organic right now is the only thing that ensures that the food is GMO free. So if it says natural, you know, even I just read a study where some potato chips or some corn chips said natural GMO free, yet 75% of it was full of GM corn. But the same company had an organic corn chip, and that was 100% GMO free. So it seems that the organic, and the company, of course, blames the raw supplier. It is very hard to track. It isn't a perfect system at every level. The grower, the farmer, the seed supplier, which we won't get into, even the manufacturer of the food, they can skirt the system some way or another, but it seems that organic really helps. And many studies have shown that adults and kids who eat organic have 10, 20, 30 times less pesticides in their blood. So it does work compared with people who eat pesticide-laden food. And it seems that a good cutoff that some of these studies have looked at is about 75 to 80%. If 75 to 80% of your diet is organic, that dramatically reduces your pesticide and chemical and herbicide intake versus if your diet was 75% traditional foods and only 20% or 25% organic. So it does make a difference. And another one that isn't often talked about in some of these books, but I think it's probably as important, if not more important, is not just what you eat, but how much you eat. So very, you know, if the diet books do go into it, it's kind of a cursory, 2,000 calories a day. Well, everybody has a different caloric need. I recommend, this is part of the individualization, that everybody get their resting metabolic rate tested. And you can go, usually you can get that at a physician's office, a chiropractor's office, a nutritionist office. Usually they offer that. And you want one that isn't just a scale that you stand on, but you want one where you breathe into it for about 10 minutes, because it measures how much oxygen at rest you are consuming. And then it extrapolates how many calories you burn, and it extrapolates that over a 24-hour period. And it can be dramatic. I mean, I've seen patients come in who are 130 pounds. You wouldn't think that they have a lot of caloric need, yet they're 1,300. And yet I've seen quite overweight and obese patients come in who are, 250, and their basal metabolic rate is less than 1,000. It could be 900. So that's going to dramatically change how much calories you take in. And I don't propose weighing your food and getting really, super restrictive about, and counting your calories. But there are some apps out there on your smartphone that you can download. And I do recommend for a couple of weeks that you use some of these apps or websites where you put in what you ate, and it will give you a rough estimate of how many calories that is. So one of the cornerstones of my diet that I like for a lot of people and myself, if it works, is eating nuts for snacks, whole nuts, not processed, but nuts are one of nature's greatest foods if you're not allergic to it or have a sensitivity to it. It's got good fats, it's got protein, it's got carbohydrates, it's got fiber. It's one of the best foods out there, and studies have shown it lowers heart disease risk, it improves cognitive function, it improves gut function. So not to go overboard on them, but that's, that's a good food to have. And a handful of nuts can be 150 calories. So, you got to have a kind of an idea of how many calories you're taking in order to keep the calories down. Now, what I usually tell people, and we'll get to this in the at the end of this talk, we'll talk about how to count calories, how to come up with a sort of, basic calorie plan. But if your resting metabolic rate is 1,000, on average, people use up about 250 calories just moving around, just kind of, if they're walking, if they're, just their daily activities, getting out of bed, taking a shower, brushing their teeth, driving to work, getting out. Of course, if you're sitting at a desk, it might be less than that. But if you have a more active job, it might be a little more than that. But 250 to me is kind of a good average. More for people who are probably, sitting around most of the time. But if you've got a construction job, then you're probably burning another 250 or 300 calories in a day, or maybe even 400 if it's 400 or 500 if it's very, heavy lifting. So you take that 1,000 of your resting metabolic rate, and you add on top of that what you think you're getting. Most people don't need more than 1,500 calories a day. To say that the average, the USDA uses, the RDAs use a 2,000 calorie a day diet. Everything's based off of that. Well, it's no wonder that most people are overweight. Even if nobody follows that, the average consumption in this country per person is 3,600 calories. 3,600 calories. Of course, they're not good calories either. They're usually fat and sugar and processed foods and chemicals that make your body store it instead of use it. So I think the point here is that calories are important, and you're going to eat far less than you think you need on this diet if you want to be healthy. Even if it's the healthiest food on the planet, if you overeat it, it causes reactive oxygen species, which are free radicals in your body. Even if it's the best food on the planet, if you overeat, it causes your body to go into a fat storage mode. It feeds bad bacteria. You get a microbial imbalance. Of course, it's better than, you know, overeating crappy food, of course, but the important thing is to remember is that, yes, even overeating healthy food is bad for you. So I've never seen a diet book that says, go ahead and eat no matter what, everything you want, as much as you want, whenever you want. If you see that in a book or hear that in a website, then you run the other way, because it's usually a gimmick. There's usually something that they're thinking is going to happen that's not going to happen. So, and then balance, a variety of foods, variety. It's kind of corny to say, but variety is the spice of life. And variety is very important because different foods have different nutritional profiles. Some have more zinc than others. Some have more B12 than others. Some have more trace minerals in them. So we want a mix of foods. And the nice thing is, in this day and age, we get to have that more than we've ever had. We can have, if you're in the middle of the country, you can get seafood. If you're living near the ocean, you can also get landlocked food, cattle, and things like that. So we don't want to rely too much on the transportation of food. And of course, we want to eat more local. But even locally, we can grow more foods and varieties than we've ever been able to before in the past. So variety is really important in your diet. So don't get stuck. It's easy to kind of get stuck on the same few foods because they work, but the more you eat of that food, the more chance you might end up developing some kind of sensitivity to it or nutritional deficiency.
You are listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota. If you're just tuning in, we are listening to Dr. Brandon Lundell in Longmont, Colorado, talking about the importance of an anti-inflammatory diet. Here we go.
So here's my diet basics after getting through these initial things that are important. I call my diet the anti-inflammatory diet because really what I find most Americans and most people from industrialized countries and really most people across the planet, because the world is so toxic, inflammation becomes obviously the driver of most diseases. That's the common pathway of most diseases. That's been known for about 20 or 30 years. New England Journal of Medicine back in 1990 came out with a study that showed that about 90% of all diseases can be traced back to an inflammatory mechanism. And of course, diet becomes one of the biggest sources of inflammation. Not the only source. There's infections, there's chemicals, there's toxins and pollutants, there's stress, there's many different sources of inflammation. But inflammation is what I see most people, obviously, who walk into my office who are suffering or needing some help. That's what almost all of them have. So the diet needs to be focused, especially if you are feeling some kind of physical ailment or mental ailment. We even know now that depression is linked to inflammation, and it is one of the main pathways of destroying the brain is through the inflammatory mechanism. So diet becomes very important. So we'll talk about the three principles or the three aspects of the diet, but again, low glycemic is common among all of the good health books out there and articles. The blood sugar and sugar in the diet trigger a lot of our inflammatory mechanisms. This is becoming more and more known, but a lot of people 10 years ago used to ask me, why is sugar inflammatory? What is it just, why is it bad for you? Well, we now know the many, many different mechanisms. It destroys the gut microflora. It helps these bad bacteria, if you will, grow and flourish. And you get a bloom of bacteria in your gut when you eat sugar that you wouldn't eat if you ate low glycemic, high fiber foods, because those bacteria don't live off the fiber. They live only off the sugar. So as they grow, then they start secreting other chemicals, what we call xenobiotics. These are chemicals from these bad bacteria that get into your bloodstream and completely change your metabolism and even how you think. So something that's been studied for the past 25 years is lipopolysaccharides. Lipopolysaccharides are are secreted by gram-negative bacteria in the gut. These gram-negative bacteria usually aren't there unless you've been eating a lot of sugar, a lot of processed foods, and perhaps a couple courses of antibiotics in there as well that didn't get followed up with the proper probiotics and prebiotics. So most people are walking around with these bacteria in their gut that are secreting chemicals that are destroying their brain. These lipopolysaccharides have been studied for 25 years. It was the first real concrete link between diet and depression. Still to this day, if you talk to psychologists and psychiatrists and medical doctors, they do not teach this. It may be mentioned, but it's very much underappreciated in the medical field how much diet really does affect the brain and indeed the immune system and the entire body. So low glycemic, high fiber, we'll talk about anti-inflammatory foods. Basically, anti-inflammatory and antioxidants are kind of interchangeable. There's some differences there, but for the most part, antioxidants are anti-inflammatory. So what do we mean? Well, we mean ultimately a lot of minerals and vitamins, because those help your body produce your own antioxidants. But we also want to take in the antioxidants like the beta carotene, the quercetin, the phytonutrients, the resveratrol that's in food, these polyphenols that are in food. Mostly they're in unprocessed vegetables, some fruit, low glycemic fruit. Even grains have phytonutrients if they're not overprocessed. So anti-inflammatory, antioxidant foods are really extremely important. And that includes how you handle your food and how you cook your food. So most food is overcooked. And, I don't believe that raw diets, 100% raw diets, are healthy for you, especially in the beginning, because if your gut is inflamed, it's very hard for the gut to extract nutrients and extract minerals and vitamins. And that's been proven. So eating a raw diet, you might feel better at first, but it's only because you're removing all the other crap, from your diet, and you feel so much better removing that other crap, the fast foods and, the stuff that you're eating, and you're replacing that. I actually call that the oatmeal effect, the cardboard effect, because all the studies in the 90s that showed that oatmeal lowers cholesterol, well, a lot of them had a big flaw, and that was that they would replace the standard American diet, which is what? The standard American breakfast is, coffee, orange juice, a bagel, a muffin, these high sugar and high fat containing foods, bacon, with oatmeal. So, of course, oatmeal is much healthier for you than eating those things every day. But they could have eaten cardboard and gotten, a similar cholesterol-lowering effect. Of course, we know oats have beta-glucans, and they do help sequester some of the cholesterol that's in food, and that does help. But again, it's more about removing the foods that aren't helpful than it is just eating a specific, one specific type of food. So building blocks. Also, we want to make sure we have enough building blocks for genetic repair, cell surface repair, which means, enough protein for our methylation, enough essential fatty acids for our cell surfaces. And we'll get into that a little bit. So remove the inflammatory foods, as I was saying. Sugar and all refined carbohydrates are inflammatory because of these mechanisms of disturbing your microbiota. When you spike your blood sugar, you also create glycosylated end products. That sugar that conglomerates with protein, and it happens in a rate limiting way. So the more sugar you have, the more advanced glycosylated end products you're going to make. I mean, it's a very specific gradient that happens. So sugar and refined carbs make these advanced glycosylated end products, and these sugar protein end products, it's actually when you make toast and you brown the toast, that browning is an advanced glycosylated end product. It's the sugar in the bread that combines with the protein and it turns brown because it makes a different molecule. Well, that molecule, when you barbecue, when you burn foods, when that molecule is there in your body, we have receptors for them, and those receptors trigger an inflammatory process. We know that advanced glycosylated end products cross the blood-brain barrier and they destroy the brain in many ways. So alcohol, flour, it's not just gluten, but flour. So I want to speak here, and I'll get to it again in a second, but right now, in this very moment, as I'm recording this, there's a huge, completely grain-free movement. And I think that that's important for a lot of people for a certain amount of time, which we'll get to. But very few people are talking about the quality of grains. A grain is not a grain. A piece of bread is not the same as a cup of cooked quinoa or a cup of cooked millet. So, something that's been unprocessed is very much different. And we talk about the quality of proteins, that a steak is not a steak. You can walk into a restaurant and order a steak, and it's one of the most inflammatory things you can order on the planet. Why? Because it's from a domesticated animal that's been fed grains, and it's not supposed to be fed grains, and it's been fed antibiotics. It hasn't exercised. It hasn't moved. It's a toxic, obese animal. And then you eat a piece of that, and somehow we think that that's going to be helpful for us. Versus an animal that has been running wild its whole life. It runs, which we all know for all animals how healthy exercise is for you and how it changes your composition, fat composition, and what types of fat and muscle protein and inflammation and metabolism. And eating a grass-fed, organic, non-GMO fed, wild caught fish, very much different than something that's been farm raised or domesticated and grown up in a large industrial scale feedlot. So a steak is not a steak, even though it looks the same on your plate. It looks exactly the same. An egg is the same way. So we talk about quality of protein, and that's, I think, more of a common conversation than the quality of grains. How has the grain been raised? Is it organic? And how has it been processed? How long have you cooked it? Cooking it too long, there's kind of a balance. Cooking grain tends to take out some of the anti-nutrients because there's some nutrients in there like phytic acids that can bind minerals, so it makes it hard for you to absorb minerals. But cooking it makes it, cook out. But then if you overcook it, you're just turning it into sugar. You're just breaking down the carbohydrates and making it a higher glycemic food. So there's a balance there. And of course, types of grains. Sushi, everyone says rice, as if all rice was the same. Sushi rice or short grain rice has 14 times more sugar than basmati rice because... And that's why they use it, because it's sticky. And when it's sticky, that's the sugar, so they can make a nice little, sushi roll out of that. If you tried to roll up basmati rice, you'd be infinitely frustrated because it doesn't stick together. And the reason why it doesn't stick together is because it has 7 times more fiber. It's all fiber, which slows the digestion and slows the conversion of that grain into sugar. So let's not lump all grains into the wastebasket and let's not just say going grain free is the answer to all things. I think it's important for a short time for some people, but long term, I think humans have adapted very well to eating grains, especially if they're active. But in small quantities. It shouldn't be the staple, which of course the standard American diet is now. Grains have become the staple, which it never was meant to be the staple. And when we look at indigenous populations, which of course there aren't any anymore, but in the 40s and 50s, when there were still indigenous populations, people like Weston Price would study these indigenous populations. And I don't agree with everything Weston Price said, but he did make the observation that most of these populations, they didn't eat any refined sugars whatsoever. And that was the biggest thing that kept them healthy. They had some grains, they ate a lot of animal protein, but good, clean animal protein. They ate a lot of things that grew around them, you know, plants, and some fruits, but very limited fruits, which we'll talk about too. So, of course, coffee and tea, it's not just about the caffeine, but the phenols and the acids in them can inhibit absorption of iron. It can inhibit absorption of nutrients. And if any of you out there are cycling fans, professional teams now in all sports are catching on to how important food is to performance. And one of the first things good teams cut out of their players' diets is the coffee and the phenols and the acids in the coffee and black tea, because they inhibit absorption and they can cause leaky gut, and they can cause a breakdown of the microvilli and our barrier system. So, And when you do that as an athlete and you limit your absorption, you're directly and immediately inhibiting your performance and creating a situation where you can get sick and injured more. So removing the coffee and the tea. In my diet, I think green tea is okay, because green tea is not processed as much as the black teas, and the coffee, it's not cooked as much. It is usually a little bit, but the white tea and the green teas are very much left almost in their natural state. And they have a lot of the antioxidants left in them. If you want to make it caffeine free, if you don't want to do caffeine, then you can steep it for about 30 seconds. The caffeine is usually what gets dissolved in the water first. It's more highly hydrophilic, so it will get taken out of the green tea before some of the polyphenols. So steep it in hot water for 30 seconds, then discard that water, pour yourself another cup of hot water, and put that bag back in it and steep it for 5 minutes. So green tea is okay. You know, mate is better if you have to replace it with something, because mate has far more minerals than coffee. Now, there's a lot of studies out there that are, I'll just say, put out by the coffee industry, that say that coffee has a lot of antioxidants. And that is true. There is some antioxidants in coffee, but a spoonful of dirt has more antioxidants than coffee. So if you really want your antioxidants, have some dirt instead of the coffee, because it really, all being said and added up and totaled, coffee actually produces more free radicals than it quenches. So, no dairy in the diet. And again, that's just because of how it's processed in the body. We want to keep it clean at first. We're talking about milk, we're talking about cheese, we're talking about butter. Some people cook with ghee, but in the beginning initial phases, I don't think that that's necessarily a good thing. There's too many potential food sensitivities that I've seen with people with dairy, and casein is a specific protein that does induce a lot of inflammatory aspects, a lot of inflammatory reactions in the body. So we're going to go dairy free for a while. Of course, fried foods, those are out. Those are immediately turned into trans fats, and it produces a ton of advanced glycosylated end products. Now, advanced glycosylated end products, which we talked about earlier in the sugar, those taste good. So we are naturally drawn to them, which is why we're drawn to fried foods. That's what gives the browning effect on the fried foods. But just remember, every time you're eating a browned food, baked food like that, you're eating inflammatory advanced glycosylated end products, no matter what it is. So, again, chemicals in our food are everywhere. They're known to be carcinogenic, inflammatory, toxic, and endocrine disrupting. I have a 400-page textbook all on the known endocrine disrupting chemicals in foods, everything ranging from how they've been genetically modified produces more endocrine disruptors, to how they're processed, to how they're packaged, to, you know, even the plastics of the package rubbing off on the food. So there's a lot of things to stay away from in packaged foods. And we talked about already overeating, not to overeat, and getting a food allergy or food sensitivity test done so that you're not eating foods that you have a reaction to. Now, just a quick word on food allergies and food sensitivities. They're not necessarily the same, but you can have a food reaction and not feel it physically in the body. So a lot of people, a lot of people propose doing an elimination diet where you just eat, you know, some fish and some vegetables for a few days, 3 days, a week, 10 days, and then slowly adding in a food one by one and seeing if you have a reaction to it. And I think that that's beneficial to a point. I think that that can help you eliminate some of the big ones. But what we're really talking about is these food sensitivities or food reactions that you don't feel an immediate reaction, but what it's doing to your immune system is potentially driving autoimmune disease, or it's weakening your immune system so it can't fight viruses and bacteria as well, or it's feeding bacteria in the gut that you can't feel that in the moment. You don't always get a bloating reaction or a tired reaction or a fatigue reaction or hives or, you know, eczema reaction to a food that is stimulating your immune system in a negative way. So I do recommend getting some food allergy or food sensitivity testing. There's a lot of different ways to do that. So talk to your physician, talk to your healthcare practitioner to find out, you know, which ones they use. What I'll tell you is you want to make sure you test for IgE, which is your main food allergy. Okay, that's technically the only thing that produces a food allergy, is an anaphylactic IgE antibody. But there are other antibodies like IgG and IgA that are proving in the literature to be significant for things like autoimmune and Crohn's disease and headaches. Those don't produce an immediate reaction, but they're contributing to ill states of health. So you want to find out what those are by, usually it's a simple blood test. You can, again, contact your practitioner to find out what they recommend. So I have two phases of the diet to sort of help you decide which one you are. If you've never made any significant changes in your diet, I'm talking about real significant changes, or you're feeling any type of ill health, then you're in the healing phase. Pretty much everyone who's come to my office that is experiencing some sort of ill health, most people come to my office, they don't know what it is, they just feel off. But they might have diabetes or insulin resistance. They might have early Parkinson's or dementia. They may have something going on or some autoimmune disease. That's what functional medicine really is about, finding these things in their pre-disease states, so they don't get into disease. So if you're experiencing any of that, or just haven't done this diet before, then I recommend starting off in the healing phase. Now, really, there's not a whole lot of difference between the two, except that in the healing phase, it's you remove all grains. This is the area where most people have such altered bacteria in their gut that, you know, even if you continue to eat a few grains during this healing phase, it's not going to produce the results that you might want, because those bacteria are still being fed, your immune system is still going crazy, and your insulin sensitivity doesn't have a chance to really reset. So grains, fruits, and sugars of any kind are completely removed from this diet. Now, this diet may last. In my patients, when they first come to see me, I'm going to usually tell them to expect this to last for at least 3 months, sometimes 6 months, and sometimes longer. Now, the other thing I'll say about the healing phase is that you can repeat the healing phase. Let's say you've done the healing phase, you're in the maintenance phase, you've been in the maintenance phase for a year. You can do the healing phase for 7 days or 10 days or a month. And I do recommend that you do that several times, maybe at least once a year or twice a year. So that's the biggest difference between the healing and the maintenance phase, is removing all grains, fruit, sugars of any kind. Now, maintenance, or the long-term phase, once you feel that you have restored a certain level of health that you're happy with, if you're exercising every day, if you're you know, practicing your relaxation response and taking care of your stress levels. If you are living a detox kind of lifestyle where your beauty products have been cleaned out and they're not full of chemicals, if you are eating organically, then you can add back in some grains, as we'll discuss below. And it's okay, I think, to have a few processed, clean, organic, if possible, and most likely gluten-free, quote-unquote, treats. Now, I have a few personally. I have a few absolutes and just a few. But the ones that I have are absolute. And one of them in my diet is refined white sugar. That is poison. That is not something that we're meant to have. And it affects the brain and it affects the bacteria. It affects your mood. It triggers cravings. So really, to me, it's not worth it. And so that's an absolute for me. I may have something sweetened with an alternative sweetener, something that's a little lower glycemic. But what I'll say about that is if it tastes sweet, it's glycemic. Don't be fooled about, agave nectar is low glycemic. It is not low glycemic. It's sugar. It's turning into sugar almost immediately into your body. But if it's a little less than white sugar, which it is, because there's very few things that are higher than white sugar because it's pure glucose. It's what the glycemic index is based off of. The white sugar is the glycemic index of 100. So very few things have higher than that. But even agave nectar and honey, you're still up in the 90s, you know, 80s and 90s, high 80s, 90s. So don't be fooled. Don't justify eating that because it's low glycemic or it's sugar free. So, you know, even stevia, there's some reports out that stevia and other artificial sweeteners, we have taste receptors throughout our entire body, not just our tongue. We have sweet receptors and bitter receptors, and so do bacteria. So when we eat sugar, anything that tastes sweet, even stevia, which is zero calorie, doesn't raise the blood sugar per se through its calorie and sugar content, but it will raise the blood sugar in other ways. One of the ways is we have sweet receptors throughout our body, and our sweet receptors, when the stevia gets in our system, it actually triggers the release of glycogen in our liver, so it raises the blood sugar, and it stimulates fat production in the body, so it can even raise cholesterol, and it feeds the bad bacteria. It increases the metabolic rate of those gram-negative bacteria we were talking about earlier that can cause depression. So I think, you know, stevia can be a good alternative. Xylitol for some people, if they don't have small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. But just be careful. You know, don't think that you can. You know, the whole point is to reduce the number of sweet receptors we have in our body, and the only way to reduce the number of sweet receptors we have in our body is to reduce the amount of anything that tastes sweet or turns into sugar in our body. So that's the difference. So what is the diet? Let's get into, you know, what can you eat? We've talked about what you can eat this whole time. So let's talk about what you can eat. So what I have people do is I have them draw a big circle on their paper if you're following along, taking notes, or just in your head if you're driving. Picture a big circle and cut that circle in half. Half of that, that's your plate. That's your food plate. Half of that plate that you just cut in half is all vegetables, every meal. And we're talking about every single meal, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Yes, vegetables for every meal. And when I say vegetables, I don't mean peas, corn, and carrots. Okay, we're talking about broccoli and cauliflower and green leafy vegetables and maybe some squashes here and there. So we'll talk a little bit more about that. But half of the food plate should be vegetables. About a quarter of that food plate should be a protein, okay? And it doesn't have to be a flesh protein either, but we'll get to what kind of proteins we should have. And then about a little less than a quarter, the other half, should be some whole grains. And I don't think, and that's only if you're in the maintenance phase. And it should be, like I said, just, you know, a little bit. So if your plate is all vegetables and not salad, okay, we're not saying half of your plate is salad because that's not really a vegetable. But if you've got a lot of vegetables and a little bit of protein and, you know, maybe a half a cup or a cup of grain, you know, basmati rice or quinoa or millet, we'll get to that in a second too, then I think that's okay. And then 5% of your meal should be some good fats. And maybe if you're in the maintenance phase, some low glycemic fruits, but those should not be, we'll talk about fruits and why they've never been a staple of the human diet and they never should be. So we'll talk about that.
A huge thanks to Dr. Brandon Lindell. Thank you for this information. Again, part two will be aired next month. And of course, you can catch this on the archives at WSLR.org. You are listening to WSLR 96.5 FM in Sarasota. And please stay tuned for Democracy Now!